I noted they had a twin exhaust exit, and that immediately suggested Meteor jets. I knew this type of aircraft had an operational ceiling of around 42,000 feet and that they would probably have come from RAF Lucas in Fife, near St. Andrews. It soon became obvious they were heading toward this object's position. Both aircraft then began to separate from their close formation to form a huge circle in the sky, which on reflection I would have estimated to be in the order of 2 miles in diameter. Both aircraft performed this maneuver for about 2 or 3 minutes at least, leaving this incredible graphic imprint in the sky which would have attracted considerable attention for miles around. The aircraft eventually broke away and headed south. Sitting at the core of the contrail pattern was this object, and I immediately began to suspect something wasn't quite what it appeared to be. Firstly, the object looked considerably smaller than before. Then, within a short space of time, it seemed to increase in size to return to what was first observed, but perhaps not quite as large. As the contrails began to spread out as they tend to do with upper wind shear effects, I noted a barely perceptible drift westward of the contrail ring. As the contrail ring began to drift further westward, this object still maintained its position. I still observed this unusual, slow bobbing and oscillating motion associated with it. And then, when the ring continued moving in a westerly direction, it began to obliterate this object, and within a few minutes the object was lost to sight, soon to re-emerge as the contrail disk continued moving with the upper stream. I instinctively knew this object was much higher than the contrails by quite a considerable margin and therefore much, much larger than originally considered, and it began to become clear that the circling jets were well below this object and that it had in fact ascended to what might be regarded as a safe altitude above the jets. It must have seen them coming. On returning to his school, Ian noted that the mystery object remained in the sky, maintaining its position and altitude. By around 14:30 it had disappeared, according to the front page story in the Aberdeen Evening Express, date not known. Thousands of people had witnessed the object. Furthermore, its first sighting had been reported north of the city at about 7 o'clock. Photographers from the Express had attempted to capture the object with their large plate cameras fitted with standard wide-angle lenses, Ian reports, but failed to get any image worthy of publication. 2 years later, Ian befriended James Stewart, long since deceased, a research scientist with the Macaulay Soil Research Institute in Aberdeen, who also had observed the strange craft. He had driven home from the institute to fetch his theodolite, a surveying instrument for measuring horizontal and vertical angles with a rotating telescope. "What he told me was fascinating," said Ian. He drew what he had observed through the device, describing the object as being rounded underneath, and the top, at least what could be seen relative to the observable angle from terra firma, came to a rounded point from what appeared to be a gentle upward sweeping transition from the outer rim. He went on to say it had a beautiful golden metallic luster with high reflectivity values and totally absent of appendages, graphic markings, or symbols. Like me, he was quick to detect its motion characteristics, describing, as I had observed, this swaying motion coupled with the slow and gentle vertical bob. What he then went on to say threw me completely. He had calculated its overall diameter as being in the order of anywhere between 780 and 800 feet. And like myself, James was convinced enough to reach the conclusion that the arrival of the jets was no mean coincidence, and, as we both recognized the aircraft type, he was quick to assume they would have been taking footage with their nose-mounted gun cameras, whose field of capture was a five-position lens system. As I recall from Jane's All the World's Aircraft, each lens position allowing a level of overlap to create a near panoramic template. Years later, Ian joined the Royal Air Force for a period of 3 years, specializing in air defense work. After training at Compton Bassett in Wiltshire, he was posted to RAF Buchan radar installation, some 30 miles north of Aberdeen. A few weeks after I settled in my new role, he recounted, all the new conscripts were dispatched to RAF Lucas in Fife. It was on that visit I took the opportunity to step out of the crowd and discuss with one of the host Hunter jet pilots the 1956 sighting, even though I knew he would not have been there at the time. I remember vividly his expression of bewilderment at my question, clearly struggling to offer a response in a manner appropriate to the occasion, especially so from a lowly SAC, senior aircraftman, radar operator. He eventually responded by saying he knew nothing about such an incident, smiled slightly, and then moved away to attend to the rest of the party. Naturally, I didn't pursue the matter, as it was clear he intended the conversation to end there. 2 days following the trip to Lucas, during what I recall was a day watch for the crew I was attached to, the NCO, non-commissioned officer, of the watch came up to me when I was on the radar scope to say I had to report to the squadron leader at the watch once my break time came along. Somewhat mystified, no reason having been given, I went to his office as requested. As it happened, this officer was ex-aircrew and a fellow Scot, very well liked among the ranks as well as by lesser mortals like myself. I knocked and entered, stood to attention and all of that and then awaited his address. What happened next completely floored me, and it was clear I was in some sort of trouble. Obviously, the officer I had addressed at Lucas had reported to the base commander about my questioning over the 1956 UFO incident in relation to Lucas. That inquiry quickly got back to Buchan, probably long before we left Lucas to return to Buchan, and the most likely reached the ears of a senior controller, which then had been passed down the chain of command to this officer. As the officer at Lucas had access to all the names of the team visiting that day, my name came out of the hat as being the defaulter. The following is more or less what was said to me and, I might add, in no uncertain terms. It has been brought to my attention that you have been asking questions during your recent visit to Lucas in regard to UFOs, in particular an incident that took place in the past that you claim had involved the Royal Air Force. As a member of the Royal Air Force, and subject to your position at this base as a radar observer, bearing in mind you have signed the Official Secrets Act to which you must adhere under all circumstances, you must never at any time, on or off the base, discuss the topic of UFOs. This is a subject of the highest sensitivity and you have no authority to discuss any issue relating to it whilst in this service. If you at any time see fit to pursue the matter, make no mistake you will face a charge of the highest magnitude. The business of UFOs may be of casual interest to you, but whatever you see, hear, or learn of the subject during your time at this base is never to be discussed with other Air Force personnel, and certainly not with any civilian agencies beyond the perimeters of this establishment. It is my understanding that you are a competent, extremely pleasant and reliable individual with an interest in music, conceded the squadron leader. Don't let that standing be compromised by neglect of duty and of the things you may learn in your role in the air defense system. It was a serious hands-off call, and it left me somewhat shaken but not entirely stirred, Ian reflected. I had no option whatsoever other than to comply with what was in effect an official order. That they reacted in the manner they did sent clear messages that the military did indeed take the UFO status quo very seriously. It has long been my belief that this particular sighting represents what I would consider the most significant daytime happening to have taken place in UK airspace following the end of WEI, in terms of the actual size and shape of the aeroform, the sheer duration of the event, and how it behaved during the time frame, its altitude and, more importantly, the intervention of the military, who of course denied any involvement whatsoever. Mother ships, with regard to the enormity of alien craft, in 1963, during a private meeting in London, which included two high-ranking British officials, Chapter 19, George Adamski described the mother ships in considerable detail, which he said served all the needs of space travelers for long journeys through space. These gargantuan vessels varied in size, reported my friend Emily Crew, who was present at the meeting, but none ever landed on terrestrial ground. They were approximately 1 to 3,000 feet long and hundreds of feet in width. They had many decks, and vast spaces to section off the life support systems, for the growing of foods and the freeze storage of these supplies. They contained water purified in tanks so big, large sea creatures could swim in them, but this water was fresh and taken from terrestrial waterways such as ours here on Earth. The water could also be recycled, for example, in our skies. 1. In 1965, not long before he died, Adamski revealed additional details to Fred Steckling, some at variance with what he had stated 2 years earlier. A main base for these giant craft on Earth, he claimed, was alleged to be in a deep ravine some 200 kilometers west of Mexico City, in very rugged terrain virtually inaccessible except by helicopter. Some of the craft were claimed to be several miles in length and stacked side by side with their noses pointing to the ground, not actually touching the ground but about 3 feet above the ground, pointing downward, while the rest of the craft pointed at a slight angle straight up into the air, as if held by some magnetic beam, Henry Dohan reports. Near each nose was a hatch and steps of a sort for descending out of the cigar-shaped craft. Top-level meetings with several of the world's leaders were said to have been held in this remote location. 2. Police patrol. In the small hours of one night in the early 1980s, two Metropolitan Police officers were on patrol in Middlesex, Greater London. "I was a young police officer on night duty in a marked vehicle," Robin Berry wrote to me. "It was the area car, an old SD1 Rover, and I was the RT, radio telephone, operator, being driven by my colleague. We were traveling very slowly at about 3 a.m. from the White Hart roundabout along the Rue Islip Road, Northolt, toward Greenford. Someone had been setting fire to parked cars at this location in recent days, so we were skulking along the road keeping a watch for any dodgy-looking characters. I have to point out that, back then, the road and pedestrian traffic at this time of the morning was almost non-existent, not as it is today. As we were driving along, I noticed a large orange light in the sky over to our left, toward Rough Northolt 3, and brought it to my driver's attention. The strange thing is that when we started to talk about it, the object flew directly toward us. As it did so, it flew over a large open park area which was on our left side, leading directly onto the Rue Islip Road, Rectory Park. As it got closer, I could see that it was a huge black triangle with a light on each point and an orange ball on the middle underside. It was very large, and I estimated it to be at least the size of 2 football pitches. There were a number of pitches that it flew over toward us. It was very low and made absolutely no noise. It was so low, I couldn't see any of the sky around it. The object flew alongside our vehicle on the near side, matching our speed. I was leaning out of the car window and waving at it. We carried along the Rue Islip Road for about 3/4 of a mile with this thing still flying alongside and matching our speed, which was still slow. It was barely skimming the rooftops of the houses as it did so. My driver then stopped the car in the middle of the road opposite Greenford Assembly Hall and we both got out. The triangle then hovered directly over us at no more than 30 feet, or the height of the hall to our left. It was huge, dead still, and silent. The driver even turned off the car engine, and we could still hear nothing. I then turned on the blue light on the roof and was waving up at the craft, but got no response. After a few minutes, yes, minutes, it turned around and then slowly glided away back along the Rue Islip Road. After a couple of hundred yards, it suddenly shot up into the sky at an unbelievable speed and disappeared from view. We sort of came to our senses and jumped into the car and drove around the corner to Greenford Police Station. We told the station officer, an old sweat, who advised us to keep quiet, otherwise face ridicule from our colleagues. However, I called Rough Northolt straight away and had an interesting conversation with someone who claimed to be in their flight control tower. He basically stated that they too had seen it, had no idea what it was, and it was not worth filing an official report. So I never did. I know it sounds far-fetched, and I can't explain why neither of us tried to radio for other units to join us. We also passed neither of the cars nor pedestrians throughout the whole incident. Just as a footnote, about a week or so later a very distressed driver burst into Greenford Police Station in the early hours of one morning claiming that his vehicle had been buzzed by a bright orange light as he drove along the Rue Islip Road. This time, the station officer did report it, and that incident made the front page of our local newspaper. 4. Further events in the UK, an enormous graft, described as looking like a flying fairground, was reported high in the sky over Exmouth, Devon, on the night of August 4, 1987. Gordon Baker viewed the craft from his garden, and was joined by his wife Gloria and a neighbour, Heather Palmer, as they took turns at viewing the craft through binoculars. The object looked like two cross-shaped objects joined together, see sketch on the next page. It was definitely not an aircraft, insisted Mr. Baker. There was no sound whatsoever. I believe the object was traveling at about 35,000 feet. Then I heard the noise of a jet aircraft. I saw it pass under the lit objects, and I even checked with Exeter Airport to see if the pilot had reported seeing it. They said they had not received any reports. However, a man in air traffic control said he had a couple of objects on his radar, but did not know what they were. We watched it for about 15 minutes until it disappeared on the horizon. I don't know what it was, but it certainly had hundreds of lights on it. 5. Further witnesses came forward following publication of the report in a local paper, including former RAF technician Tony Millington and his wife Claire. It certainly wasn't an aircraft, he said. It is very difficult to say how high they were, but there was no noise at all. That is what seemed so odd to me. As we watched, the two objects seemed to get close together. We watched them for about 15 minutes before they disappeared over the horizon towards Halden Hill. The lights were uniform in brilliance. A Ministry of Defence spokesman evinced little interest when contacted. 6. Of the hundreds of British reports of large craft sighted that year, one of the most interesting came to me from Barbara Forrest, of Briarley Hill, West Midlands. At around 1900 hours to 1915 on November 19, 1987, Barbara's 27-year-old son Brett spotted two very bright lights in the sky, one small and one large, close together, from outside the three-story block of flats where she resided in Moore Street. My son said that they seemed to join together, and then it took on the shape of a diamond and became brilliant, she wrote to journalist Peter Rhodes of the Wolverhampton Express and Star 2 days later, asking to be put in touch with me. Brett and Barbara sent me colored sketches, depicting how the craft appeared in three stages, finally coalescing into a huge elongated triangle with a series of grooves underneath, colored black, silver, and bronze. As Barbara recounted for me, the craft came over the street light where he had been watching it for quite some time. Brett thought he had to tell someone or he would never be believed, so he ran down the grass embankment to my living room window, knocked very hard, and as I opened it he said, "Mom, look up." And there it was, massive, wonderful, and frightening. Here was something that in the first instance had been two very bright lights, very still in the night sky, then the whole thing lights up in the shape of a diamond. Then it starts to move, and as it came nearer and lower it dimmed its lights. It passed right over the block of flats where I live. I was amazed at what I saw, a great floating airship all lit up underneath with many, many white lights. There was no noise, it was massive. That thing was so low, it was unbelievable. I watched it go right out of sight as it went in the direction of the high street. There were two aircraft in the vicinity at the time, with their normal red and green lights. Her first sketch depicts what she saw as the craft was directly above her, with black serrated edges which when a little distance away looked as though they were kind of grills. The inner part of the craft was a grey or silvery colour. There were strips underneath. The lights were fluorescent, very white and bright. The second sketch, varying from her son's depiction, shows the object seen floating silently away. One could no longer see the individual lights or the shape of the craft. This thing must have wanted to be seen, otherwise it would just have zoomed away. It seemed to follow my son. I have never seen anything like it in all my 57 years. In actual fact, This is starting to worry me now. Perhaps whoever was in that floating city may not like us very much. 7. 3 weeks following the Briarley Hill sighting, another event occurred, one of numerous reports from Nottinghamshire at that time. It was obvious to all the witnesses that it was not a normal aircraft and it immediately drew their attention, reported a journalist. Most reports say there was a deep humming noise, faint but distinct. All agree that the object was huge, and most say that a jet aircraft was seen shortly after the UFO. I knew it was huge, 20 or 30 times the size of a normal aircraft, and it made a distinctive deep throbbing noise, said Edward Fell, of Long Eaton. 8, see photo section. France and Canada, on the night of November 5, 1990, numerous sightings were reported over Europe, some involving enormous craft reported by Air Force pilots as well as civilians. In my previous book, I cited a report from Jean-Gabriel Gresel, a former French Air Force fighter pilot, who also flew U.S. Air Force jets on an exchange in the 1950s, as well as an Air France captain. He is now one of Europe's leading UFO researchers. A précis of this important case is warranted here. At 1900 hours, together with six of his martial arts pupils, Jean was standing outside a gym in Gretz-Almain-Vers when an enormous crane-like object came into view at a height of around 300 meters. It projected two huge, divergent beams of light, not quite touching the ground, he told me at the actual site in November 2004. It must have been at least 1,000 feet long, with a thickness of about 200 or 250 feet, and it had triangular substructures and many, many lights, see photo section. I ran around a tree to watch it as it turned its back on us, and the lights dimmed very quickly, which is surprising, because the beams must have been at least a kilometer in length. Then it disappeared in the clouds. It carried with it what I can only describe as a zone of silence, because as it flew over us, at never more than 100 miles per hour, we suddenly didn't hear the nearby traffic. And I had the impression that my mind was blanked out. It was absolutely incredible, like a city floating through the clouds. 9. The following report was sent to me by Dr. Richard Haynes, the well-known researcher, whose past employment includes posts with the National Research Council, Boeing Airplane Co., and at NASA's Ames Research Center, where he served as chief of the Space Human Factors Office and in other research positions. Co-author of the report was Bernard Gannett, a professional computer graphics expert, and a witness to the event. On November 7, 1990, between 40 and 75 people, including Royal Canadian Mounted Police, a CMP, and Montreal Urban Community Police, MUCP, witnessed a huge aerial object, beaming shafts of light, which hovered at around 6,000 feet above downtown Montreal between about 1930 and 2200 hours EST. Many of the witnesses were located on the 17th floor of the International Hilton Bonaventure Hotel. Three journalists from La Presse arrived at the scene. 1. Marcel Laroche took two photos of the craft, but owing to cloudy conditions only the light beams could be seen. One of these photos was published in La Presse the following day. The lighted object had six lights on the perimeter of a large circle with a ray of light emitting from each one, stated the paper. Most witnesses described the rays as white, while some also claimed they saw blue, yellow, and red lights. An Air Canada pilot who witnessed the event from the rooftop of the Hilton Hotel estimated the altitude of the object at between 8 and 10,000 feet. While driving home from work between 2230 and 2300 hours, a.m., Pierre Courmartin saw very big and strong lights in a boomerang shape low in the sky. On arriving at his home, not far from the Long Point military base, CFB Long Point, he watched the object hover near the Hydro-Quebec Long Point power station. When he got out of his car, he heard a purring sound and thought the object was a dirigible, with only its gondola visible below the cloud base. As Dr. Haynes points out, CFB Long Point contains 48 regular forces, detachments and units, of about 1,900 persons, 25 reserve units, and 97 Cadet Corps with 7,500 persons. It also supports three military schools. No one at the base could be found who saw the aerial object on November 7th. A power failure, or tension, was experienced between 2308 and 2350 at the Long Point military base. The base is fed by a 12,000-volt lead from the Hydro-Québec Long Point power station. It is the only one which broke down on November 7th, and a check of the operating records of telecommunications networks, etc., did not uncover any unusual malfunctions. Perhaps of equal importance with the overall scope of the aerial phenomenon was the almost total lack of official response to it. No action of any kind was taken by personnel of the St. Hubert military base after they were notified of the aerial object hovering above the center of the city. As far as is known, they did not even report it to the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, Coordination Center. 10. The Williamsport Wave. On February 6, 1992, the Pennsylvania Association for the Study of the Unexplained, PASU, headed by Stan Gordon, began to receive numerous reports of a series of low-level sightings in the vicinity of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, which had occurred the previous day. To assist in his investigations, Gordon sought the collaboration of Dr. Samuel DiGreco, a retired Air Force major and aerospace engineer who served as the Pennsylvania State Section Director for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, which liaised closely with PASU. The wave of sightings on February 5 occurred from about 1800 hours to 1900 hours. Two different kinds of object, boomerang and triangular shaped, had been seen in the evening sky, and there had been numerous persons who had witnessed the sightings, Dr. Greco reported. All the sightings followed a similar pattern. Apart from one, all originated in the houses of the witnesses. Typical descriptions follow: a loud or heavy rumbling noise above the house which shook or vibrated the building and rattled its windows. Witnesses would then leave the house, see the object, and alert others. Object usually boomerang shaped. One witness, who stood directly underneath, described it as triangular shaped. A few other shapes were reported. See sketches. Lights or portals on the craft could be seen. The span of the boomerang-shaped object was variously estimated at 100 to 600 feet. The object moved very slowly, at low altitude, often surrounded by moving red and green lights. Animals displayed irrational behavior. Object disappeared suddenly. There were no aircraft in the sighting area reported either by commercial air sources, the Federal Aviation Administration, or the USAF, concluded Dr. Greco. The witnesses were ordinary people going about their daily lives, who were considered reliable, honest, and sincere, and did not want their names released to the public. 11. Dr. Greco's diagrams of the various shapes of craft, seen in one day alone, appear below, not here. See a rig.book. There was no noise. Then the most extraordinary thing happened. When the huge object was just gaining height, a missile appeared to be fired at one of the yellow UFOs which were still over the hills opposite me. It came from behind one of the hills and went sharply up, trailing a yellow flame. As it approached the UFO, I prepared for an explosion, but the yellow light of the UFO went out for a split second. There was a white spark, and the missile seemed to be deflected toward the hotel, to the left of where I was standing on the balcony. I watched the missile, which was glowing or burning red, go past and just over the hotel, heading out to sea. It was about the length and half the height of a single-decker bus, and horizontal in flight. When the missile was fired, all the UFOs, including the massive one, stopped moving for 15 minutes. The latter just remained suspended in the sky. Then they all began moving again, upwards and outwards over the sea, still at the same slow pace. This went on until 4:40 a.m., when a vivid green and blue semicircular object appeared over the sea above the wing of the hotel, below the huge UFO and between it and the hotel. It was much lower and was flashing blue and green intermittently, at times the colors intermingled. At 4:45 a.m. another missile was launched at the last yellow UFO, the nearest one to the hills, and the same thing happened as before, except that when the deflected missile came past the hotel, it was not glowing red like the first one, only yellow at the rear end. At 4:50 a.m. all the UFOs were getting higher in the sky, but it was noticeable that the huge one was not getting appreciably smaller the higher it got. The huge object seemed to me to look like some kind of transporter, because of its lighting, color, and shape. It was dull and workmanlike with only three strips of light, at least that I could see.